exposition of the words of Jesus in five books was still around extant in manuscript form as late as 1218. So from the first century, you could still find the five books written by Papias, exposition of the words of Jesus, written somewhere around the beginning of the first century. And manuscripts were available as late as 1218, but for some reason have entirely disappeared as complete manuscripts. A few of the fragments have come down through Irenaeus and Eusebius. Now, Eusebius is known as the father. Put him down. E-U-S-E-B-I-U-S. Eusebius is the father of church history. In the minds of most people, as Herodotus or Herodotus is the father of history, the Greek historian. Neither one of them really are. They just put together the first recognized formalized history. Eusebius wrote History of the Church. Irenaeus wrote Against Heresy. Now, as we were limited to what the opponents of Gnosticism had to say in our knowledge of the Gnostics until the Nag Hammadi finds, primarily, there were other little breakthroughs, but the attention-getting find was the find in the late 40s of Nag Hammadi. Now we have access to a cache of Gnostic literature, original sources, and we're not just dependent upon the writings of Irenaeus, Tertullian, and others who were telling us why we shouldn't believe in Gnosticism, and in the process telling us why, but telling us what they thought or said Gnostics believed. That doesn't mean they were inaccurate. But you're on safer ground analyzing what the Gnostics really believed by having now access to original Gnostic doctrines written by the friends of Gnosticism instead of the enemies. I'm sure if Hitler had won the war, we'd have a different history of Europe. We sure have a different history of the Jews. That wouldn't make it right. Might makes right in some history. Now, likewise, Papias is not the enemy of Irenaeus or Eusebius, except on certain points. But since 1218, when the last extant manuscript of Papias' five-volume series disappeared, what we know about Papias' writings appears as excerpts in the writings of Irenaeus and Eusebius, primarily. Got that? Now, it's entirely possible. Maybe it's already been done. This was written in 1908. It's entirely possible that a Papias set will appear with the rush of archaeology. Have they? Well, let's go on with this. At least we know after 1218... until 1908, maybe later, all five had disappeared. A few of the fragments have come down through Irenaeus and Eusebius and others, more or less spurious, through later ecclesiastical writers. And though of extraordinary interest, yet are they so problematic and obscure that it's impossible to derive safe conclusions from them. Two fragments of Papias that makes you hungry to have a copy of all five books. Two fragments of occasion most discussion. One of the fragments is from the preface to his five books, and the other from some unknown place in the work. We don't know which book or what place. In the preface, Papias writes as follows: "But I shall not hesitate also to include with the interpretations." Now, see this author writing a preface to his five volumes, the five volumes being entitled Exposition of the Words of Jesus. In the preface he says, "I shall not hesitate also to include with the interpretations whatsoever things I have at any time well learned from the presbytery and well remembered, giving assurance of their truth. For I did not, like the multitude, take pleasure in those who speak much. You wouldn't like Jerry the Fat. But in those who speak the truth. They like me. Not in those who relate strange commandments, but in those who deliver the commandments given by the Lord unto faith and springing from the truth itself. And it's interesting. One lone voice in the wilderness. If then anyone came who had been a follower of the presbytery, I questioned him with regard to the words of the presbytery, what Andrew or what Peter said, or what Philip or Thomas or James or John or Matthew or any other of the disciples of the Lord, and what Aristion and the presbyteros, John, the disciples of the Lord, say. For I assume beforehand that what was to be gotten from books would not profit me as much as what came from the living and abiding voice. That's his preface. It's been fought over. There's two pages here of the theories and the arguments as people looking back on this preface, and it may explain why that the five volumes disappeared in the 12th or the 13th century. Because certain people's theories about the history of the church required that Papias be born about a century later. But if he talked to John, then they're in trouble. Now, part of the reason why they wanted to have him born later is because another thing that he has is going to give substance to the writings of John. And there was a great fight to have John the Apostle not the writer of the book of Revelation, because there was a move to leave the book of Revelation out. And once they crossed the hurdle in their competition with Marcion, who would restrict the canon of Scripture to Paul and Luke, and they wanted to expand the canon of Scripture to any apostle, then if John the Apostle wrote the book of Revelation, they're up that proverbial creek without a paddle. So in order to when in their argument, a few centuries later, when they're arguing to canonize the Scripture, leave the book of Revelation out, indeed, because the Montanists have so misused prophecy, leave the apocalyptic literature out completely, they have to have an author for the book of Revelation that is not John the Apostle. That then makes the term presbyter or elder a term applied later than the apostolic age to some John the Presbyter, a fictional John, if those who believe in the original dates of Papias are correct, or a second John that's been overlooked, that because of a misunderstanding of whomever, was not John the Apostle, and was a second later John who wrote the Revelation, who lived in Ephesus, and who was banished to Patmos, and who wrote the book of Revelation, but was not the Apostle John. The entire problem revolves around the term presbytery. It is seen that the name John is used twice. Are both names of one and the same person? Let's read it again. If, then, anyone came who had been a follower of the presbytery, I questioned him with regard to the words of the presbytery. What Andrew or what Peter said, or what Philip or Thomas or James or John or Matthew or any other of the disciples of the Lord. And what Aristion and the presbyteros, John, the disciple of the Lord, say. Are these one and the same John? Well, it seems obvious to me. But it's important to some who have a private agenda that they not be the same John. It is seen the name John is used twice. Are both names of one and the same person? Irenaeus states that Papias was a hearer of John and a companion of Polycarp. Immediately after citing this, Eusebius, in his history, who cites that statement of Irenaeus, asserts that the words of Papias in the preface by no means imply that he was a hearer and an eyewitness of the apostle, but that he heard the doctrines from those who were their friends. Now, for years, the British based their history on a belief that Geoffrey of Monmouth, Chronicles of the English Kings, was a basically factual record, embellished to be sure, but seated in fact. The Normans conquered. Now it became the task of someone under patronage of the new rulers to break the long-standing link that Britain, through its kings, had with Troy and assert the Norman heritage. To do it, he had to destroy the credibility of Geoffrey of Monmouth, which he did. And now, down through the centuries since that point, when a strong voice of power in the British frame attacked the credibility of Monmouth and ridiculed the chronicles, except in literature and drama and opera and music and poems, if it's just literature, Geoffrey of Monmouth has been looked on as legend. And the roots of British history were changed deliberately. Very few people go back and examine the arguments given to destroy the credibility of Geoffrey of Monmouth. When you look at them, they begin to self-destruct on their face. The bias is so apparent. Now, someone today told me they heard on the radio that some radio station off up somewhere had offered, publicly, had offered a job for Jim Baker, $20,000 a year, rooms in the YMCA, or the equivalent thereof, and if he lacked transportation, bus tokens. Now, you'd better understand, folks, the hatred the world has for anything called Christian. I hate these people and their technique of doing things, and I've been saying it for 11 years. But I'm continuing to have my sense of justice violated. You don't find anybody offering that kind of treatment to Dwight Gooden. They offer him mercy and rehabilitation and hope that he can restore himself and start right. You don't find anybody offering that kind of treatment, which is, you know, satirical cynicism dripping with evil. At first glance, humorous. At a longer look, sick. It comes from the same kind of nature that when the successful Jews in Germany finally began to be pulled by the Nazis off of their posts, those that had resented them turned to animals in their vicious attempts to go beyond sanity in the treatment of these people. We're seeing a mob like the French Revolution. I mean, I heard an editorial tonight dragging out that old thing that was fought out years ago. Churches, whether TV or not, are public charitable trusts. My friend who writes the editorial, why don't you read the California Corporations Code, which specifically states by statute, religious corporations are not charitable trusts. If you don't like that, go to the legislature and change the law. But don't mislead the public in an editorial position. It's a blind, no basis in fact attack on that which is hated. We better understand. If you were of the world would love his own, but you're not of the world because I've chosen you out of the world, therefore the world hateth you. I understand. There is a war going on. And it's full of prejudice and full of bias. And when the desire to change the image of English history came about, Geoffrey of Monmouth was destroyed. What's being done to Jim Baker goes beyond all human reason. There wasn't as much hatred for Nixon. I mean, he's kind of a harmless little guy. There's not as much hatred for the Marines who compromised our security. There's not as much hatred for Poindexter and North. There's not as much hatred for Boesky. Why this poor little old preacher? Whose sex life wouldn't make good graffiti in a toilet. Unleashing so much hatred. This, my friends, is a pin-up hatred for the church at large that has found a target. There's not as much hatred for the teenagers that stomped the head of a First Natural this past week in Los Angeles. I mean, I could sympathize, maybe applaud him, chasing and beating him a little bit, but after he's down stomping on his head, that's going a bit far. We better understand what's happening. What's this got to do with Papias? Eusebius had a private agenda. He had to not let Papias appear as he was. And Eusebius, though he was the first church historian, was not without motives of his own. Well, let's leave old Papias hanging here. It means it's time to go to Eusebius. Take a look at the old squirrel. Now, dictionaries and encyclopedias are kind of nice to read if you know something else, or have somebody can read it to you to tell you something between the lines. Otherwise, you kind of get lost with them. There we go. Let's see what old you've got to say about Eusebius. You got Papias hanging there on your list? I'll get back to him sometime before we finish the King's Chamber. Well, which Eusebius? Well, there was the Pope Eusebius. He was Pope 309. His pontificate lasted only from April 18th to August 17th. After which, in consequence of disturbances within the church which led to acts of violence, he was banished. He died in exile in Sicily. Ain't much changing about the church, is there? He died in exile in Sicily. Then there was Eusebius of Alexandria. He didn't amount to much. Then there was Eusebius of Angiers. He's first met with as Bishop of Angiers at the Synod of Reims in 1049, and for a long time had been an adherent of Berengar's doctrine of the Lord's Supper. As such, he was regarded by Berengar himself and by his opponents as an adherent. But when he recognized the strength of the opposition, he favored a compromise. He's remembered because he was on one side of a church fight. Big deal. Now, here we go. Eusebius of Caesarea. Eusebius of Caesarea, the friend of Pamphilius, bishop of Caesarea in Palestine, the father of church history, was born about 275 or 280, place unknown, died at Caesarea, maybe. At the latest, 340. Most probably May 30th, 339. So we're in the 4th century now, when church history's father comes on the scene. Little is known of his youth. He became acquainted with the presbyter Dorotheus in Antioch. Here we go again. Every so often I drop those little zingers so that you'll know I haven't forgotten where we started all this. You ever going to put... Yes, I'm going to stay with this till I put it together. I promise you. It might lead me into the pyramid. On the downward... the descending passage. In 296, he was in Palestine and saw Constantine. The emperor... who visited the country with Diocletian. He was in Caesarea when Agapius was bishop. Well, we'll leave him alone for a while. And made the acquaintance of Pamphilus, who became his intimate friend. With him, he pursued studies which seemed to have related chiefly to the preparation of a correct text of the Bible. With the aid of Origen, we're going to have to go to Origen, Origen's Hexapla, and commentaries collected by Pamphilus. This old English is interesting. Hello, you who joined us. I'm reading about Eusebius of church history, called the father of church history, born about 275 or 280 A.D., died at Caesarea, maybe, probably 339 A.D., friend of Pamphilus, made an acquaintance of Pamphilus in Caesarea, who became his intimate friend. In 307, Pamphilus was thrown into prison, but Eusebius continued his intercourse and studies. The fruit of their common labors... Who says church history isn't interesting? Was an apology for Origen, in which Pamphilus and Eusebius collaborated, which was finished by Eusebius after the death of Pamphilus and sent to the martyrs in the mines of Pheno in Egypt. After the death of Pamphilus, Eusebius seems to have gone to Tyre, and later to Egypt, where apparently he first suffered persecution. The charge that he purchased his liberty by sacrificing to the gods is unfounded. Well, we'll see. Eusebius is next heard of as Bishop of Caesarea. He succeeded Agapius, whose time of office is not known, but Eusebius must have become bishop soon after 313. Nothing is known about the first years of his official activity, but with the beginning of the Arian controversies, he becomes prominent. Arius appealed to him as his protector, and from a letter of Eusebius to Alexander, it is evident that he aided the exiled presbyter. Now we're into fights of the 4th century in the great Arian controversy, which we'll come to. It was that great controversy that made Constantine say, we're going to have an official council and settle the differences. And the Council of Nicaea, for the first time, had the weight, the full weight of the Roman Empire behind its pronouncements. The church and government had had their bad marriage, too hot in here. Now that's the scenario of Eusebius' activities. When the Council of Nicaea met in 325, Eusebius was prominent in its transactions. He was not naturally a leader or a deep thinker. Jerry the Fat. But, as a very learned man, I overestimated Jerry, and well-trained in history, at the same time a famous author who enjoyed the special favor of the emperor, he came to the front among the 300 members of the council. The confession which he proposed became the basis of the Nicene formula. Eusebius was variously implicated in the further development of the Arian controversies, as, for instance, in the dispute with Eustathius of Antioch. Eustathius combated the continually growing influence of Origen and his allegorizing exegesis, seeing in his theology the roots of Arianism. Eusebius, on the other hand, was an admirer of Origen and employed the same principles in his exegesis, treating the Old Testament as allegorical, taking what Paul did with Abram and Hagar and Sinai and seeing it as an allegory. They expanded it to the position Origen did, that all the Old Testament must be interpreted allegorically. Eustathius reproached Eusebius for deviating from the Nicene faith and was charged in turn with Sabellianism. Write that one down.
For more of the teaching, please go to the next tape. Thank you.